accounts of the centuries-old battle between code makers and code breakers. In part one, the birth of codes and ciphers, and how an inadequate code led to the downfall of a British monarch.
On the morning of Wednesday, the 15th of October, 1586, Mary, Queen of Scots, entered the crowded courtroom at Fotheringay Castle. She was on trial for treason, accused of plotting to assassinate Queen Elizabeth in order to take the English crown for herself. A group of conspirators had already been arrested and executed, but the question remained, was Mary behind the plot? Was she equally culpable and therefore also deserving of death? In fact, Mary had sanctioned the plot, but she had been careful to ensure that all her correspondence with the conspirators had been encrypted using a cipher. The encryption turned her words into a meaningless series of symbols, and Mary believed that even if Elizabeth's agents had captured the letters, they could have no idea of the meaning of the words within them. If their contents were a mystery, then the messages could not be used as evidence against her. However, this all depended on the assumption that her cipher had not been broken. Not for the first time, a life hung on the strength of a cipher. The Greek historian Herodotus is responsible for some of the earliest accounts of secret writing. He chronicled how Histieus shaved the head of a messenger and then wrote upon his scalp. After waiting for the hair to regrow, he dispatched the messenger, who could travel unhindered, because any guards en route would not be aware that he was carrying a message. Upon arrival, the messenger simply shaved his head and showed the message to the intended recipient. This strategy for achieving secret communication relied on simply hiding the message, and is known as steganography, from the Greek words steganos, meaning covered, and graphein, meaning to write. In the 2,000 years since Herodotus, various forms of steganography have been used all over the world. The ancient Chinese wrote messages on fine silk, which was then scrunched into a tiny ball, covered in wax, and swallowed by the messenger. In the 16th century, the Italian scientist Giovanni Porta described how to conceal a message within a hard-boiled egg by making an ink from 1 ounce of alum to a pint of vinegar, and then using it to write on the shell. The solution penetrates the porous shell and leaves a message on the surface of the hardened egg albumen, which can only be read when the shell is removed. Steganography also includes writing in invisible ink. Back in the 1st century AD, Pliny the Elder explained how the milk of the tithymalus plant could be used as an invisible ink. Although transparent after drying, gentle heating chars the ink and turns it brown. Many organic fluids behave in a similar way because they are rich in carbon and therefore char easily. Indeed, it is not unknown for 20th century spies who have run out of standard issue invisible ink to improvise using their own urine. The longevity of steganography shows that it certainly offers a modicum of security, but it suffers from a fundamental weakness. A thorough guard might routinely search any person crossing the border, heating blank sheets of paper, shelling boiled eggs, shaving heads, and so on, and inevitably there will be occasions when the message is uncovered, at which point the enemy can read the message. So, alongside steganography, there was the evolution of cryptography, derived from the Greek word kryptos, meaning hidden. The aim of cryptography is not to hide the existence of a message, but rather to hide its meaning. One of the earliest forms of cryptography was the substitution cipher, which was independently invented by various ancient civilizations. The substitution cipher appears in the Kama Sutra, which advises women to use it to conceal the details of their liaisons, and the first documented use of a substitution cipher for military purposes appears in Julius Caesar's Gallic Wars. The substitution cipher turns the original message into an enciphered message by substituting each letter with a different one. So, every A in the original message may be replaced with P, every B with K, and so on. In effect, the original alphabet is being rearranged into what is known as the cipher alphabet. there are over 400 million, 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 million ways of rearranging the letters of the alphabet. And so an enemy codebreaker cannot hope to decipher an intercepted message by checking every possible rearrangement. In fact, if an enemy agent could check one of the possible rearrangements every second, it would take roughly a billion times the age of the universe to check all of them. For over a millennium, ancient scholars considered that the substitution cipher was unbreakable. However, codebreakers did eventually find a shortcut to deciphering messages. The breakthrough occurred in the East and required a brilliant combination of linguistics, statistics, and religious devotion. The 8th century AD heralded the golden age of the Islamic civilization. Having acquired the art of papermaking from the Chinese, the Arabs were able to establish a burgeoning publishing industry, which satisfied and encouraged the most literate and learned society in the world. In just one suburb of Baghdad, there were over 100 bookshops. Religious scholarship was also at its peak, and this provided a vital ingredient for the breakthrough that would destroy the security of the substitution cipher. The Quran consists of 114 revelations made to the Prophet Muhammad between 610 and 630 AD. Arab theologians were interested in establishing the chronology of the revelations, and they did this by counting the frequencies of words contained in each revelation. The theory was that certain words had evolved relatively recently, and so if a revelation contained a high number of these rare words, then this would indicate that it belonged to the latter part of the chronology. Theologians also studied the hadith, which consists of the prophet's daily utterances. They tried to prove that each statement was indeed attributable to Muhammad. This was done by studying the etymology of words and the structure of sentences, in order to test whether particular texts were consistent with the linguistic style of the prophet. Significantly, the religious scholars did not stop their scrutiny at the level of words. They also analyzed individual letters, and in particular, they discovered that some letters are more common than others. The letters A and L are the most common in Arabic, partly because of the definite article al, whereas the letter J appears 10 times less frequently. This apparently innocuous observation would lead to the first great breakthrough in code breaking, made by the Arabic polymath Al-Kindi, otherwise known as the Philosopher of the Arabs. Al-Kindi was the author of 290 books about medicine, astronomy, mathematics, linguistics, and music. His greatest treatise, which was only rediscovered in 1987 in the Suleymaniye Ottoman Archive in Istanbul, is entitled A Manuscript on Deciphering Cryptographic Messages. Al-Kindi's code-breaking technique is most easily explained by imagining a message, originally written in English, which has then been encrypted and which has fallen into the hands of an enemy code-breaker. Al-Kindi advised the code-breaker to look for the most common letter in the encrypted text. If the most common letter is, say, W, then this probably represents the letter E, because E is the most common letter in English, accounting for roughly 13% of all letters. Similarly, the second most common letter in the encrypted text probably represents T, and the third probably represents A, the second and third most common letters in English. This technique, known as frequency analysis, relies on linguistics and mathematics, as well as a certain level of guile, guesswork, and intuition. Consider the following brief message. In Zanzibar, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Zaire, ozone zones make zebras run zany zigzags. If this were to be encrypted, then the code breaker would have to apply frequency analysis in a flexible way, so as not to be caught out by the unusually high number of Zs. Nevertheless, the text could still be deciphered in a matter of hours. The security of the substitution cipher had been destroyed. By the 16th century, Western code breakers had taken on board the techniques of frequency analysis, and those sending secret messages could no longer be confident that their letters were not being read by the enemy. However, cipher secretaries had nothing else to rely on apart from the substitution cipher, and so they continued to employ it for their correspondence, even though they were aware of its frailty. In 1586, some letters were smuggled into the English prison that was holding Mary, Queen of Scots. She had arrived in England 18 years earlier, having fled from Scotland, where she was being threatened by Scottish nobles. She had sought protection from her English cousin, Elizabeth I, but the Protestant English queen saw Mary as a Catholic rival and immediately imprisoned her. One of the letters to Mary had been sent by Anthony Babington, a 24-year-old Catholic rebel. Babington's letter described how he and his colleagues would assassinate Elizabeth and then release Mary and put her on the English throne. Mary immediately sent a reply to Babington, giving her blessing to the plot. All the correspondence between Mary and Babington had been enciphered, and the letters were smuggled into and out of her prison by Gilbert Gifford. Each letter was wrapped in a leather packet, which was then hidden inside a hollow bung used to seal a barrel of beer. Gifford was in cahoots with the local brewer, who would take the barrels into and out of Mary's prison. Neither Mary nor Babington were aware that Gifford was a double agent. Each time that Gifford was supposed to deliver a letter to or from Mary, he would make a detour and visit Sir Francis Walsingham, principal secretary to Queen Elizabeth and her chief spymaster. Walsingham passed the enciphered correspondence to his chief codebreaker, Thomas Phillips. A master of frequency analysis, it was merely a matter of time before Phillips would decipher Mary's letters. He established the frequency of each character and tentatively proposed values for those that appeared most often. When a particular approach hinted at absurdity, he would backtrack and try alternative substitutions. Gradually, the significance of Mary's reply to Babington began to emerge. Mary's letter endorsed Babington's plot, and this was the crucial evidence that would lead to Mary's trial and execution. Phillips marked the letter with a gallows sign. The trial was held in Fotheringay Castle, a bleak, miserable place in the middle of the featureless fens of East Anglia. Mary's main defence was to deny any connection with Babington. "Can I be responsible for the criminal projects of a few desperate men," she proclaimed, "which they planned without my knowledge or participation?" But the deciphered correspondence proved that this was not the case. The death penalty was recommended, and Elizabeth signed the warrant. On the 8th of February, 1587, in the great hall of Fotheringay Castle, an audience of 300 gathered to watch the beheading. Walsingham was determined to minimise Mary's influence as a martyr, and he ordered that the block, Mary's clothing, and everything else relating to the execution should be burned in order to avoid the creation of any holy relics. Mary was equally determined that her final appearance should be a defiant gesture, an opportunity to reaffirm her Catholic faith and inspire her followers. Richard Wingfield, in his narration of the last days of the Queen of Scots, described her final moments. While one of the executioners held her slightly with one of his hands, the other gave two strokes with an axe before he cut off her head, at which time she made very small noise and stirred not any part of herself from the place where she lay. Her lips stirred up and down almost a quarter of an hour after her head was cut off. Then one of her executioners, plucking off her garters, espied her little dog, which was crept under her clothes, which could not be gotten forth but with force, and afterwards could not depart from her dead corpse, but came and lay between her head and shoulders, a thing diligently noted.